Content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today's program is generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander and Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. We're reading this week from the August 20th, 2021 issue of The Week magazine. The cover drawing this week shows the Hungarian strongman Viktor Orban in the center. He's got sort of a sunburst behind him. He looks like a big strong man. He's got on a muscle shirt, red muscle shirt with the Hungarian flag on it. He's flexing his arm, and Fox News host Tucker Carlson is standing there beside him, and he's got his arm on Orban's bicep and looking admiringly at him. And the headline is "The Orban Option: Why Carlson and Far-Right Populists Are Fawning Over Hungary's Strongman." That is our controversy of the week. We'll get to shortly. We'll start with two of the shorter main stories this week. First is Cuomo resigns in wake of harassment report. What happened? New York Governor Andrew Cuomo this week announced plans to step down after losing the support of nearly all allies and facing certain impeachment over allegations that he sexually harassed 11 women, including 9 state employees. In a 20-minute-plus speech, Cuomo said that Attorney General Letitia James' report, which detailed incidents of Cuomo touching a subordinate's breast and buttocks, contained serious issues and flaws, and maintained that his accusers misinterpreted his motivations. But he also claimed he wanted to spare the state a long, costly investigation that would consume government. After the release of James' report last week, many prominent Democrats, including longtime allies, called on him to resign. And when his top aide, Melissa DeRosa, quit, he reportedly realized he had no chance to survive. Cuomo said he will leave office within 14 days of his announcement, and it remains unclear whether the New York State Assembly will continue its impeachment inquiry. At least 5 district attorneys have launched inquiries into the alleged sexual harassment, including a claim that Cuomo groped an assistant's breast. Federal investigators are also looking into Cuomo's handling of nursing home COVID deaths in 2020. Hours before Cuomo's announcement, the New Yorker published an article detailing Cuomo's efforts to quash state and federal ethics probes in 2014. Cuomo's term, which continues through 2022, will be served by Lieutenant Governor Kathy Hochul, a moderate Democrat who will be the first female governor in the state's history. What the columnist said: "This is a good day for New York, but a better one for the country and for women in workplaces across the country," said Ruth Marcus in the Washington Post. Not that Cuomo is truly contrite. In his speech, he quasi-apologized in one breath and took it back in the next. Nonetheless, the system worked. Women came forward, an investigation corroborated their claims, and a once fearsome leader faced consequences. Future Cuomos will feel less emboldened that they can escape unscathed. For better or for worse, Cuomo was New York's most consequential governor in generations, said Kyle Smith and NationalReview.com. He pushed through useful, lasting projects such as the first new Manhattan subway line in 25 years. But the egotistical governor also made many enemies, and his March 2020 mandate that nursing homes readmit COVID patients proved catastrophic. Between that and the sexual harassment scandal, his egregious arrogance did him in. So, to its credit, did the Democratic establishment, said Benjamin Parker in TheBulwark.com. While the Republican Party has lately delighted in elevating serial abusers to prominence, including its still enormously influential last president, Democrats abandoned Cuomo to his fate, much like they cast out Senator Al Franken in 2017. They remain capable of policing actual bad actors within their ranks. That's because, right now, the Democrats are a political party, while the Republicans are a personality cult. The second main story, which clearly would have been written before this week's events, Taliban offensive gains speed as U.S. exits Afghanistan. What happened? The Taliban were routing government forces across Afghanistan this week, seizing at least 9 provincial capitals in a matter of days as U.S. and coalition forces continue to exit the country. U.S.-trained Afghan soldiers surrendered to Taliban fighters in the northern commercial hub of Kunduz. Videos posted online from the city's airport show militants parading in American-donated Humvees and pickup trucks. In the western city of Farah, Taliban fighters dragged the dead body of an Afghan security force member through the streets while shouting, "Allahu Akbar." In captured Zaranj, soldiers and civil servants were ordered to come forward and collect immunity cards and were warned by the Taliban, one resident said, that they will be killed right away if they work for the central government in Kabul. The U.S. is doing little to aid Afghan government troops, providing air support to soldiers in only 2 besieged southern cities. President Biden said he does not regret his decision to withdraw all U.S. forces by August 31st. "Look, we spent over $1 trillion on Afghanistan over 20 years," he said. "They've got to fight for themselves." Still, U.S. officials are surprised at the speed and success of the Taliban offensive. The group now controls more than 2/3 of Afghanistan, and U.S. intelligence officials believe it could capture Kabul within 90 days. What the columnist said: the U.S. has abandoned the Afghan women and children it promised to protect, said Ruth Pollard in Bloomberg.com. In some areas, the Taliban are going door to door and compiling lists of women and girls ages 12 to 45 for their fighters to forcibly marry. Schools and colleges are being shuttered, and women are being told they cannot work, study, or dress as they please. How can Biden simply stand aside and watch as the Taliban take Afghanistan back to the dark ages? What's happening to the Afghan people is cruel and unjust, said Matthew Ho in Newsweek.com. But it's not Biden's fault. The Afghan military is collapsing because of motivational mismatch. While the Taliban fight for national liberation, Afghan soldiers primarily fight for pay. Pay that the kleptocratic government in Kabul is unable to consistently deliver. Meanwhile, the ethnic warlords who once sided with the U.S., many of whom are drug lords and war criminals, are safeguarding their power by striking new deals with the Taliban. The crisis could have been avoided if Biden had sought a satisfactory resolution to the war rather than rushing for the exit, said Eric Edelman in TheBulwark.com. Now hundreds of thousands of refugees are fleeing Afghanistan, an exodus that could destabilize neighboring Pakistan, a nuclear power, and potentially Europe if enough head west for safety. The administration claims that drawdown will free the U.S. to confront an aggressive China. But who in the world would want to work with the U.S. in that struggle if we abandon our Afghan partners to be slaughtered like sheep? And our controversy of the week, as described in the cover drawing, Hungarian Rhapsody, Carlson's embrace of the Orban model. Tucker Carlson has just shown America a frightening picture of what the ascendant far right wants for this country, said Paul Thornton in the Los Angeles Times. Fox News' most watched cable host spoke to viewers from Hungary last week, where he did a fawning interview with its autocratic president, Viktor Orban. Carlson presented Orban as an iron-fisted defender of traditional values who's showing U.S. conservatives how to crush the cultural left. If you care about Western civilization and democracy and families, Carlson claimed, you should know what is happening here. The influential Carlson's embrace of Orban, said Jonathan Chait in nymag.com, is an important milestone in the Republican Party's long evolution into authoritarianism. Orban's 11 years in power offer a blueprint for transforming a democracy into a dictatorship, including extreme gerrymandering, installing loyalists in the judiciary, and seizing control of the media. Carlson and fellow right-wing nationalists such as J.D. Vance and Steve Bannon are openly calling Orban a model for the next American president. What they seem to want is a leader who shares Donald Trump's contempt for democracy, but possesses a subtler touch. It's not Orban's perceived overreaches that had the American establishment so worried, said Rod Dreher in the AmericanConservative.com. It's his idea that a country can be what he calls an illiberal democracy with elections, yes, but with a government based on Christian faith and traditional Western values. Orban correctly perceives that Western liberalism has surrendered to a civilizational death wish with its contempt for religion, traditional families, and patriotism. Orban has used government to push back, offering generous subsidies to families with children and celebrating national pride. American conservatives need leaders like Orban who will stand up to the cultural imperialism of our new woke overlords. Unfortunately, many post-Trump Republicans share that siege mentality, said Zach Bocamp in Vox.com. They believe the specter of an all-powerful left justifies seizing control of local election boards, extreme gerrymandering, packing courts with far-right partisans, and creating a media propaganda network that encloses its viewers in a bubble of fear and alternative facts. Actually, conservative fear of the cultural left's power is not a delusion, said Ross Douthat in the New York Times. It really has become dangerous to one's career and reputation in America, corporations, universities, and media to share political opinions that conflict with progressive orthodoxy. But a long-distance Hungarian romance with a corrupt, dishonest leader is not the answer. As a conservative, I find it honestly weird that the American right would look to the example of Hungary, said David French in thedispatch.com. It's one of Europe's poorest nations, with a government that distributes European Union funds to Orban cronies and a population that is far less religious than that of the U.S. So many of Hungary's own citizens are immigrating to escape its corrupt, weak economy that Orban has quietly welcomed more immigrants to address its worker shortage. Carlson is too smart to really fall for the Orban con, said Ann Applebaum in theatlantic.com. But his cynicism has become so profound, he is portraying Hungary as a nirvana without America's racial diversity, its modern culture, its free press. As Carlson well knows, his faux patriot fans love America only in theory. They hate it as it really is. It's our good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for American exceptionalism after a YouGov survey found that Americans are an average 7.8 points more confident than Brits that they could beat various animals in a one-on-one fight, including a medium-sized dog, a chimpanzee, a kangaroo, and a goose. It was a good week for air conditioning after yet another punishing heat wave, with temperatures over 90 degrees, roasted about 175 million Americans in two dozen states from the Pacific Northwest to the Northeast. And it was a good week for standing your ground after a Texas restaurant posted a front door sign saying that because of the Delta outbreak, patrons are required to wear masks again and advising those who call the staff sheep, anti-American, or communist that we survived death threats from the NRA whack jobs, so we should be okay not serving you meatloaf today. But it was a bad week for loyalty, with a report that former President Trump has consistently ignored or rejected pleas for help from Rudy Giuliani, his former lawyer who now drowning in legal bills resulting from his chaotic efforts to keep Trump in office. It was a bad week for O.J. Simpson, who says he doesn't visit Los Angeles because the murder of former wife Nicole Brown Simpson remains unsolved. I might be sitting right next to whoever did it, he explained. And it was a bad week for high expectations. After Oregon Democratic Governor Kate Brown scrapped the requirement that high school students demonstrate proficiency in math, reading, and writing so that more minority students can graduate. The nonprofit Foundation for a Better Oregon thanked Brown for her commitment to every student's success. And a short and other news piece while we're here. Pentagon mandates COVID-9 vaccines. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin will require all 1.3 million active duty U.S. service members to get vaccinated for COVID-19 by mid-September, the Pentagon said this week. President Biden indicated that he would sign off on the order a week after he mandated COVID shots for all federal employees, unless they agree to undergo regular testing. About 65% of all military members are already fully inoculated, with the Navy leading the way at 75%, and the Marine Corps lowest at 59%. During the pandemic, the military has enforced distancing measures during training and added isolation periods before and after deployments. The mandate could take effect sooner if the FDA gives full approval to the Pfizer vaccine later this month, as expected. The briefing this week is titled The Pandemic Pet Boom. Lockdown loneliness created unprecedented demand for furry friends. Now it can be hard to get one. How many pets found homes? Roughly 13 million U.S. households added a pet last year as breeders and shelters were overwhelmed by Americans stuck at home and craving companionship. Puppy sales increased by more than 40%, and animal adoptions soared at similar rates, including 2 million cats. During lockdowns, dogs and cats provided a play pal for household kids, an office mate for at-home workers, and, with dogs, a much-needed excuse to go for a walk. Adoptions and purchases brought the U.S. dog and cat population to 160 million, roughly double what it was half a century ago. Annual spending on pet food and care, in turn, has reached $103 billion and expected to nearly triple over the next decade, thanks to the explosion of new pet owners. As Morgan Stanley analyst wrote recently, welcome to the patriarchy. Why are pets in such demand? They're good company and easy to love. Studies show that pets lower humans' blood pressure and reduce feelings of anxiety, loneliness, and depression. Humans have lived with dogs for 40,000 years, a relationship that, through breeding and natural selection, has shaped dogs to be people pleasers. In the modern era, that bond has grown much more intimate, with people giving their dogs and cats clothes, Instagram accounts, and a spot on the bed. Roughly three-quarters of millennials are pet parents, many because they're unmarried and want company or have decided it's too expensive to raise a human child. As demand increases, sterilization has cut down supply. More than 80% of dogs and 90% of cats are spayed or neutered, compared with roughly 10% in the 1970s. With fewer unwanted dogs than ever, competition for one has become ferocious. How does adoption work? Today, adopting a dog can feel a bit like gaining admission to an Ivy League university. With demand far outstripping supply, rescue agencies sometimes put prospective dog owners through multiple rounds of interviews, ask for references, and even demand a Zoom tour of an applicant's apartment. Joanna, a Manhattan nurse, told the New York Magazine that she and her architect husband applied for a dog last year and were grilled about which of them would take the dog if they got divorced, where it would go if they both died of COVID, and whether they could take 3 days off from work to help the dog acclimate to its new home. "I take care of cancer patients," the nurse told her shelter inquisitor. She was very unsatisfied with our answer. Carrie McNally, a PhD biologist, tried to adopt a golden retriever in the Boston area, but found that goldens and golden mixes were quickly scooped up at shelters. Breeders told her she could join a 2-year waiting list. Even the ASPCA's current president, Matthew Berkshadker, was twice denied a dog, with shelter employee telling him, "You work too much." What about buying? It can also be difficult, with some breeders advertising multi-year waiting lists. Last year, Sarah Stewart of Cohasset, Ohio, was turned away by 10 dog breeders. Finally, she found a waiting list for $1,900 Welsh Terriers. A few weeks later, she and her husband were invited to pay a deposit for a newborn puppy, and the Stewarts waited until 11:59 p.m. to be sure they were the first in line. They somehow still missed out and were told that the next litter of Welsh Terrier puppies would cost $2,700 each. It's now common to pay $4,000 for some purebreds, and prices for designer crossbreeds like the coveted Bernedoodle have soared to an average of $5,089. A fully trained Bernedoodle puppy can go for more than $20,000. Is adoption more popular? About 2/3 of U.S. pets are adopted. That practice is now widely viewed as more humane than buying from breeders or puppy mills, high-volume dog factories that compel mother dogs to churn out litter after litter and lock up both parent dogs and pups in filthy cages. There are an estimated 10,000 puppy mills in the U.S., according to the Humane Society. Despite the stigma, buying is often now the only option. A mother identified as Heather told New York Magazine about her futile attempts last year to adopt a dog for her family. "People get a little spicy when you say you paid for a dog," Heather said. "You want to scream that you tried your hardest, but it wasn't possible." Are adoptions working out? Most pet owners are happy with their companions, despite the chewed sofas, shedding, and barking. As society reopened this year, a feared rush of Americans putting pandemic pets up for adoption did not come to pass. But if kids return to school and adults to work this fall, there is concern about a looming separation anxiety crisis. Andrea Tu, a New York veterinarian who prescribes anxiety and depression medication for pets, says both pets and owners are in for a shock. "They can't leave the dog alone for 10 minutes, Tu said, much less for 10 hours. Into a few of the best columns. Start with two from the U.S. Ian Millhiser from Vox.com writes, the GOP's plan to cancel Atlanta. Georgia's new voting law could let state Republicans rig the 2022 election, said Ian Millhiser. GOP members of the state legislature have announced that they will subject Fulton County, which includes Atlanta, to a performance review as permitted by the voting law they passed in March. As justification, the lawmakers cited the fact that 200 ballots were scanned twice during the initial counting in the 2020 election in Fulton County, which Joe Biden won overwhelmingly. The simple error by an election worker was corrected in both a machine and hand count. But we're about to see the most ominous provisions of Georgia's new law in action. If it chooses, the Republican-dominated State Elections Board could use the performance review to override a county elections board and install a temporary superintendent, likely a Republican. The superintendent would have the power to disqualify voters, move polling precincts, and potentially even refuse to certify an election count. Fulton County may appeal, but the State Elections Board, State Legislature, and State Supreme Court are currently controlled by Republicans. A mechanism is in place that could result in the mass disenfranchisement of Atlanta voters, just as Donald Trump wanted. Why we need constitutional amendments. The last meaningful amendment to the Constitution passed 50 years ago, said Jesse Wegman, and the process the founders set up for the evolution of our political system has come to a standstill. The 26th Amendment lowered the voting age to 18 to enable those being drafted during the Vietnam War to have a voice in whether they'd be forced to participate in that deeply unpopular conflict. Amendments have been crucial to our nation's evolution, banning slavery, establishing a federal income tax, and giving women the right to vote. The Constitution's framers provided an amendment process because they knew that future generations would need to adapt to changing times. Today, however, the nation is too polarized for any constitutional amendment to get through Congress and receive approval by 38 states. Despite popular support for such reforms as limits on campaign contributions and banning partisan gerrymandering. As a result, the power to decide crucial issues has devolved from the people to the Supreme Court and locked our political system into an institutional paralysis. Beware, great empires decline or descend into civil war when they aren't able to evolve and reflect what most citizens want. This column comes from Sweden. The EU hasn't the first idea about forestry. The European Union has unveiled a plan to curb the use of wood as energy source while planting 3 billion trees by 2030 in a drive to meet ambitious climate targets. Sounds harmless, right? Wrong, said Tobias Wilkström from Sweden, for Sweden, where 70% of the land is covered by woodland and where forestry accounts for 10% of all jobs, the plan could be devastating. The EU's strategy is based on a misunderstanding of forestry. It views trees solely as a carbon sink that must stay untouched at all costs. In reality, a responsibly managed forestry industry can help cut carbon emissions by providing alternatives to energy-intensive materials such as concrete and steel in buildings or plastic in packaging. The European Union also warns of a worrying trend towards deforestation. While that's true worldwide, it's not true here. More trees are planted than felled in Sweden, because most of our forests are owned by long-term entrepreneurs who understand the need to manage their resource sustainably. So far, the EU's forestry plan has unclear legal and constitutional status, but if the European Commission, the bloc's executive branch, tries to enforce it as law, we'll have Brussels, not Stockholm, running one of our major industries. Will the Swedish government speak up for Swedish trees? The last word, our in-depth article, Walking Around the Earth. Tom Tursich and his dog, Savannah, have traveled 20,000 miles on foot, said journalist Ann Babe in Afar magazine. After crossing 39 countries, they're still meeting people and learning lessons in kindness. April 2nd, 2015. Living the dream, setting out. I'm officially a professional explorer. There are many ways to walk. One may stride or stroll, amble, ramble, mosey, or wander, all of which imply a certain leisurely aimlessness when, bestowed with the grand luxuries of time and money, there was nowhere in particular to be and nothing in particular to do. Yet there are also more determined, more decisive forms of traveling on foot. Hiking, trekking, tramping, and trooping among them, these convey a sense of purpose or a place, the elements that lend structure and meaning, even if mundane, to the path ahead. One might commute long stretches of concrete, going city block after city block, only to reach an endpoint as ordinary as the office. Or one might traverse on something like a spiritual pilgrimage, a distance that deemed to be iconic, say the height of Mount Everest or the length of the Great Wall. But no matter where one walks, each journey unfolds in fundamentally the same way. One foot after the other, one step at a time. Tom Tursich, on a mission to circumnavigate the world by foot, has walked all of these ways. Since leaving his home in New Jersey in April 2015, the 32-year-old has rescued a puppy named Lulu in Texas, whom he now calls Savannah, and been held up at knife point in Panama and halted by life-threatening sickness in Scotland. He has celebrated the nuptials of strangers in Turkey and waited out a global pandemic in Azerbaijan, returning to the U.S. multiple times along the way for recovery following his illness, for rest, for visas, and for a COVID vaccine. What he once expected to be a continuous 5-year journey will be a piecemeal 7-year one. Currently back in the U.S. with 39 countries and 20,000 miles behind them, Tursich and Savannah still have Seattle to New Jersey and 3,000 miles to go. Returning to their home country at this point of the journey, before Mongolia and Australia, is not what Tursich had imagined. COVID made sure of that, but there's no question they will finish. That, he assures us. December 12, 2016. Day 612. The great thing about walking every day is that despite being exposed to the elements, I have a purpose each and every day. Walk. I never fall asleep unsure of what I'll do with tomorrow. I know I'll learn a little more and grow a little more with each new area I pass into. In most everyone's experience, there comes an experience so profound that it fractures life into two, the time before and the time after, and at the fault line in between is the moment of deciding to do something. For Tursich, that moment came when he was 17, when a close friend died at age 16, and the thing he decided he would do was see the world, not just on a fleeting greatest hit style vacation, but as a sustained lifestyle with all its ups and downs. Of course, as a high school student who'd never been away from his family home for more than a few weeks, Tursich wasn't prepared to set off right away. For one thing, his bank account totaled less than $1,000. And for another, he didn't have the slightest idea of what seeing the world actually meant to him or even how to begin to conceptualize it. So he bided his time. He read widely, scouring travel sites and researching where to go and how to get there. He graduated from university with a degree in philosophy He worked and lived with his parents while he paid off student loans and saved up money. He considered what makes for a full life, a fulfilled life. His way of traveling, he decided, would be to walk. Tersich put the word out. He threw a fundraiser and held a press conference, ultimately landing himself a sponsor that agreed to financially back him. On the day before his 26th birthday, he departed, carrying with him a sleeping bag and tent, a portable cook stove, a Leatherman knife, battery pack, a few changes of clothing, some food, and some water, packed into a cart that he pushed ahead of him, and a bag he strapped onto his back. He hadn't planned his exact route, only its general trajectory, knowing he wanted to head south toward Uruguay, catch a boat to Antarctica, then hop a flight to Ireland, travel eastward, and cross Central Asia. It was a quiet time on the road, just him and Savannah, the pad of their footsteps, the whir of the traffic, the rustle of the wind, and the exchange of words with the occasional other person they passed by or fellow pedestrian they came across. He documented his daily progress to share online, writing blog posts on his website, theworldwalk.com, and posting pictures and videos on his Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube accounts. In the early days, Tersich was only able to cover 10 or 15 miles before his legs would give out. He shed pounds, lost toenails, his ankles swelled, his feet blistered, but eventually he worked his way up to walking about a marathon distance every 24 hours. On day 34 in Sandbridge Island, Virginia, he upgraded to a new cart after his old one had weathered broken tires and snapped axles. By day 66, he burned through his first pair of shoes. And after 186 days, he'd made it to his first national border at McAllen, Texas, and crossed into Reynosa, Mexico. 10 U.S. states down, 44 countries to go. March 9, 2017, day 667. My thoughts nearly ran out in those deserts. I had no more mundane problems to work through, no more bad memories to rehash. My mind was a blank slate, and when I stared at the stars, I questioned my very existence. What is man to build his life on, I would think. He can work until his fingers bleed, construct great statues, and rage against the gods, but in the end he is still dissolved to nothingness, a grain of salt in the universal ocean. He wants success, he wants fame, he wants to be handsome or beautiful, he wants to live in a penthouse and wants everyone to know it. All those things are means to an end. Man wants them because he believes they will make him happy. But in and of themselves, they mean very little. Secure enough wealth to live, then direct your efforts towards helping others. To be happy and to make others happy is the end. In 1589, Sir Robert Carey walked from London to Berwick, or 300 miles, simply because it was bet that he couldn't. In the mid-1600s, King Charles II of Scotland completed the earliest documented race walk, traveling 13 miles from Whitehall to Hampton Court on foot. And in 1762, a man by the name of John Haig undertook the challenge of covering 100 miles in just 24 hours in what was the world's first recorded centurion. From 1860 to 1903, the United States' most popular sport didn't involve any balls, bats, or rackets. It was distance walking, and it drew legions of fans. In the 1860s, Edward Payson Weston, today's so-called father of modern pedestrianism, walked his way to fame, first by going from Boston to Washington, D.C., for President Lincoln's inauguration, and later from Portland, Maine to Chicago, completing 1,326 miles in just 25 days. In 1874, a man named Daniel O'Leary broke the six-day walking record, becoming champion pedestrian of the world. The public's fascination swelled, and the cash prizes did too, reaching upwards of $20,000, more than $500,000 in today's money. It was amid this footing frenzy as ultra-walking enthusiasts sought to stretch the distances even farther and raise the bar ever higher that a wild idea was lobbed about. What if someone were to walk the circumference of the entire planet? Several tried and failed. Some attempted to dupe their way through it, tricking spectators while raking in the sponsorship money. Others claimed to do it but couldn't get their achievements independently authenticated. Nearly a century later, a lanky Minnesota man named Dave Kunst became the first verified pedestrian circumnavigator. Setting off with his brother John in 1970, he finished with another brother, Peter, in 1974, after John was shot dead while walking through Afghanistan. Kunst's world walk is recognized by the Guinness Book of World Records, though not by the World Runners Association, the WRA, because his 14,500 miles don't meet the WRA's 16,300-mile minimum requirement. To verify it, he used a scroll stamped by the mayor of each town along his journey. Today, authentication generally relies on GPS data, videos, and photographs. Since Kunst, at least 10 others have successfully followed in his footsteps, albeit on different routes. British ex-paratrooper Carl Bushby, who set off from Chile in 1998 on a trek known as the Goliath Expedition, aiming to be the first person to walk an unbroken path around the world, hasn't completed his journey yet. But Tersich credits him as his greatest inspiration. Combining Bushby's route with Kunst's, Tersich created the one he's more or less following now. March 18, 2018. Through my 2 years of walking, I've been taken in by friends, family, and complete strangers. In a new city or on a tough road, there's nothing better. You not only get a warm bed and a shower, but are given a peek into another life. I've woken to mountain views, to pigs oinking, to life in big cities, and in each, I imagined I were on a different path, living with different circumstances, and how altered a person I'd be living there. It's like sampling flavors and learning what I like about each. More importantly, with each new family that brings me in, my desire to give back grows. I fantasize about the day I can open my own doors to all these good people. For Tersich, some days are the push-on days, with climbs so abrasive and landscapes so uninspiring that in his mind all there is for him to do is put in his earbuds and listen to a This American Life podcast or an electronic music playlist to power through. Other days, intrigued or charmed or cloaked in comfort, he finds himself wondering if he might allow himself to linger where he is. Sometimes he does, as when he paused for a few weeks at Lake Atitlan to learn Spanish or met up with friends for breaks in Bogota and Lima. In Uruguay, he hunkered down with extended family as he did in Ireland, Croatia, and Copenhagen. Over the 1,577 days he's walked thus far, Tersich has learned how to read the weather and appreciate it when it's nice, how to take a better photo, and write a moving essay. He's learned to take days off. But out of all the lessons he's learned, perhaps the most basic, the most important, is that good people really are everywhere. What is traveling the planet if not meeting and greeting all the life that inhabits it? Brushing shoulders with and bidding best wishes to some of the many billions of beings who make their home, just as you and I do, in this most precious space. On his own walk, Tersich has witnessed many others, the walks of life of all the people he's crossed paths with, the people who put him up for a night, the rancheros, farmers, construction workers he's passed on the road, mathematicians, birders, teachers, a husband scattering his wife's ashes. But the fact is that Tersich is not like a majority of the people he meets. And as a white man with one of the most powerful citizenships in the world, he never will be. He acknowledges this privilege. What would it be like to walk around the world as a black man, a brown woman, to try to do everything Tersich has done, go through police checkpoints, cross international borders, bribe immigrations and custom officials, set up camp on the private property of strangers, sleep in parks and schoolyards and cemeteries, as a person with less privilege? Tersich can't know. No one can truly know what it's like to walk in another's shoes, dragging their steps one day and going footloose and fancy-free the next. The roadblocks they came up against, or the detours they go down. There are so many ways to walk. Tom Tersich's walk around the world is only one of them. This was adapted from a story that first appeared in Afar magazine. I'm going to read an obituary today that has a personal connection to me because I, in fact, grew up outside of Tallahassee, Florida in the 1970s. The coach who brought glory to Florida State, Bobby Bowden, 1929 to 2021. When Bobby Bowden took over as head football coach of Florida State University in 1976, the team had won only four games over the previous three seasons. He joked that whereas University of Alabama fans had "Beat Auburn" bumper stickers, FSU stickers read "Beat anybody." Bowden, a folksy showman who favored dadgummit over profanities, went on to beat almost everybody, compiling 304 wins over the next 34 years. His teams finished in the top five of the Associated Press rankings every season from 1987 to 2000 and won national championships in 1993 and 99. A devout Southern Baptist, Bowden took his entire team to church services before season openers. On the field, he preached discipline. "All religions have commandments," Bowden said. "If kids would obey them, the world would be a better place." Bowden was born in Birmingham, Alabama, the belly of football country, said the Los Angeles Times. He and his bank teller father would sit on their roof and watch football practices at the nearby high school. Bedridden at age 13 with rheumatic fever, Bowden listened to radio broadcasts detailing World War II battles and would later model his coaching after military commanders such as Douglas MacArthur and George Patton. A star running back in high school, he made the University of Alabama team in his freshman year, said the Washington Post. Fed up with warming the bench of the Crimson Tide, he left Tuscaloosa after one semester to marry his high school sweetheart and then played quarterback for Howard College in Birmingham. After coaching stints at several schools, Bowden was hired to revive the team in Tallahassee. He had one losing season, his first, and then assembled his dynasty, said the Tallahassee Democrat. Bowden paired a fast-paced offense led by Heisman Trophy-winning quarterbacks Charlie Ward and Chris Winkie with a speed-focused defense. He popularized trick plays like a daring fake punt with 90 seconds left that clinched a victory over Clemson in 1988. Bowden was pressured into retirement in 2009, 20 wins behind college football's winningest coach, Penn State's Joe Paterno. The NCAA later vacated 12 of Bowden's wins because of an academic cheating scandal, but he remained a campus legend. Nicknamed Saint Bobby, he disliked being treated as a figure of reverence. "There's only one person who's ever been perfect on this earth," Bowden told his six children, "and he ain't your daddy." And we'll turn on over to the Talking Points page. Start with an article. The Olympics, salvaged by the athletes. The Olympics may just be unkillable, said Will Leitch in NYMag.com. It seemed like insanity to hold the games in Tokyo amid a COVID-19 outbreak, but the games managed to reach the finish line last week, and the world got sucked in by the athletes and their performances. The U.S. took home the most medals overall and most gold medals, thanks largely to dominant performances by its women athletes, including its track, wrestling, volleyball, and basketball teams. Star U.S. gymnast Simone Biles redefined her legacy by withdrawing from the team competition and sparking an important conversation about mental health in sports. After she withdrew, American Suni Lee won the gold in the women's all-around as the first ever Hmong American Olympic gymnast. At times, the absence of spectators made events feel joyless, and this led to some dreadful TV ratings. Still, the Tokyo Games muddled through. Yes, Japan pulled it off, but it came with a price, said David Zirin in MSNBC.com. Within the Olympic bubble, 387 people caught COVID, and visitors reportedly shirked masking rules and left the premises to explore the city. The Japanese public never wanted these Olympics, or the public health risks, or staggering price tag that came with it, said Yasmin Saran in TheAtlantic.com. Now the world is looking ahead to the 2022 Winter Olympics, which Beijing will host in 6 months, despite China's atrocious human rights abuses in Xinjiang and elsewhere. For all their history, pomp, and pageantry, the Olympics have now become synonymous with overspending, corruption, and autocratic regimes. The Olympics did get one thing right, said Rachel Bachman in the Wall Street Journal. Organizers have continued to add more women's events to the Games, and the schedule is now close to 50-50. U.S. women rose to the occasion, winning 60% of the U.S.'s medals. The federal Title IX law that bars gender discrimination in high school and college sports has driven explosive growth in women's athletics. These athletes use their Olympic stage to stand for women's empowerment, said Gabriela Miranda in USA Today. Allison Felix, who gave birth via an emergency C-section in 2018, won 11 medals and became the most decorated track Olympian in U.S. history, while advocating for mothers everywhere. These games may be remembered partly for COVID, but they still managed to inspire. We'll read some of the shorter notes here. 1 in 4 women serving in the U.S. military reports having been sexually assaulted, and more than half say they've experienced harassment. Of the more than 6,200 sexual assault reports by military personnel in the last fiscal year, only 50 ended in conviction. Average pay in U.S. restaurants and supermarkets has topped $15 an hour for the first time as businesses struggle to find enough workers. Nearly 80% of American workers now earn at least $15 an hour. A federal judge is allowing Norwegian cruise lines to require passengers to show proof of vaccination. The judge issued a preliminary injunction against a state law banning such a requirement after the company cited Florida's skyrocketing COVID case count and said having unvaccinated passengers could lead to super spreader events on board and wherever they disembark. The median net worth for black households with college graduates in their 30s has plummeted to $8,200, down from an inflation-adjusted $50,400 three decades ago. During that time, the net worth of equivalent white households grew 17% to $138,000. High levels of student debt and lagging income growth are the key factors behind the drop. On the poll watch, 72% of Democrats believe governments can take actions to slow climate change, compared with 24% of Republicans. 82% of Democrats, 49% of Independents, and 27% of Republicans believe that human activity is warming the planet. Two-thirds of Republicans say wildfires, prolonged droughts, and severe hurricanes are events that just happen from time to time. And we've got time for two quotes. The first is from Studs Terkel, who says, "More and more we are into communications and less into communication." And finally, a quote from Barbara Kingsolver, who says, "Pain reaches the heart with electrical speed, but truth moves to the heart as slowly as a glacier." And with that, we've run out of time for today's episode of the week. I hope you've enjoyed it. Be sure to listen again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. Today's program was generously underwritten by W.G. Alexander. At W.G. Alexander & Associates, they take pride in providing clients with the best legal counsel by concentrating on elder law, asset protection, and estate planning. They can be contacted at 919-256-7000. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please give us a call. That number is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.